We continue now our sessions on Hinduism by talking about the four stages of life in Hindu doctrine. Four stages of life, of course, has in mind a Brahmin, a male who is born in the high caste, the highest of the castes, and what his career should look like. And it starts with a being a student, and then being married and establishing a household. And then finally, when someone gets older, they should become a hermit in their old age, go away and live on their own, support themselves, concentrate on their spiritual welfare, try to divest themselves of attachments to the world of illusion, Maya, and then finally become a mendicant, a begging monk who has severed every tie with earth and every other person and is longing only to achieve nirvana. The four goals or ways of life correspond then to three methods of attaining nirvana. And the three main ones are the way of works, the way of knowledge, and the way of worship. And any one of these ways is supposed to be equally good with any other. In fact, the way of knowledge has kind of edge and then has a historical superiority. But it wasn't open to everybody to follow this, to meditate on the Vedas and the Upanishads and the holy writings, and devote oneself to achieving through meditation that state which happens in a flash and in a trance, and in which someone sees the truth that there is only Brahman Atman and that all things are really one, and therefore loses attachment to the illusory world, and is guaranteed then that upon death they will not be reborn into yet another life in that wheel of fate called samsara. These three ways, I said, are given equal status officially, but unofficially, this way of being a monk and a from the beginning, and the priest is regarded as superior. The way of works allows the average person to have hope of achieving nirvana, and there is a code for this. It's called the code of Manu. It's mostly about how a Brahmin should conduct his life, how a man should proceed in order to achieve nirvana and try to escape the wheel of rebirth, but it has some things in it that are very remarkable about the role of women, which shows what I was saying last time about the women being on the very lowest scale, up beneath the lowest caste. It's pretty shocking stuff, but here's how some of it goes. There is no other god on earth for a woman than her husband. The most excellent of all good works that she can do is to seek to please him by manifesting perfect obedience to him. Even if her husband is deformed, aged, infirm, offensive, even if he's sick, immoral, a drunkard and a gambler, even if he visits prostitutes and lives with them, has no affection for his home, behaves like a raving lunatic, lives without honor, even if he's blind, deaf, dumb, crippled, in a word, no matter what his defects are, a wife must always look upon him as her god and lavish him with all her affection and care, paying no heed whatsoever to his character or his actions. Pretty fantastic stuff. And of course, the final thing in the code of Manu is that if her husband dies, then they go to burn his body. She's to jump onto the funeral pyre and commit suicide as the final act of devotion to him in an act called sati, sacrificing herself. And that guarantees that she will be reborn in the next life as a man. It's that practice that the British tried to suppress when they ruled India. Under the Raj, they made it illegal. But it was still practiced in remote areas, and it survives to this day. And it's, again, it's has had official rejection sometimes from Indian governments, but no one has really tried to stamp it out with any great success. So that has to do with the way of works, and the way of knowledge is that of the scholar meditating on the holy writings and devoting himself to achieving nirvana by the trance. And then there's also the way of worship, which was, again, a way of opening up to the average person the hope of achieving a higher rebirth or achieving nirvana, or at least a higher rebirth. And that worship comes mainly through writings like the Bhagavad Gita. And the worship has to do with being focused on avatars such as Krishna. Now, this idea of an avatar is fairly unique to Hinduism. And it's one I've had a Hindu priest say to me that only Hinduism and Christianity saw the need for an embodiment of God to appear on earth. And he was equating avatar with incarnation. I'll have some more to say about that when we get to Christianity and we talk about the incarnation. There are remarkable and important differences between the two, but there is a common idea there. An avatar is the appearance of a god in the form of a human. The human isn't real. I mean, it's not really a human. It's illusion, like the rest of the illusory world in which we live. But it is the appearance of a god. And that's what Krishna is taken to be. And all the stories about Krishna have to do with his mediating knowledge of the divine and the divine way to people, being able to manifest it by appearing to them in human form and engaging in them with them in very human ways. Of course, in one sense, the whole of our common sense reality, all the world that we live in, is an avatar of Brahmanatman, because the claim is that this is all appearance, but it's an appearance of what is really only Brahmanatman. Brahman's the only reality. All the things that we experience that are different, that have different qualities and different sizes and locations and shapes and things that change, that come into being and pass away and all that, that's all Maya. It's all mere appearance, illusion. Because the being of those things is really Brahmanatman. It is inconceivable and changeless. So in that sense, the whole of reality is already an avatar of Brahmanatman. But the avatars are regarded, such as Krishna, are regarded as having a special status because they appear in the world in order to make the divine known. And the other rocks and trees and mountains and clouds don't do that, but Krishna does. So they have to do with achieving a better reincarnation. And of course, I mentioned last time that reincarnation could also demote you. If you live a wicked and selfish and cruel life, then you may come back as something much worse than what you lived in this life. One of the worst things you could come back as, in Hindu opinion, is a jackal. The Indians look down on jackals as not an honorable or admirable animal. But you could come back as worse than that. You could come back as an insect or some such. So there is always that threat. As the as time went on, Hinduism came in greater contact with other religions, particularly Christianity, and then later again Islam. Some of the ideas of nirvana changed. There were thinkers who proposed that they conceive of nirvana not as just a drop being reabsorbed into the ocean, not the individual person passes into nirvana and is just absorbed into Brahmanatman and so escapes pain and suffering and woe. But some thinkers changed this idea. Ramanuja, for example, and Madhva. And in the Middle Ages, what are the Middle Ages in the West, thought of it more as passing into the presence of Vishnu and a life that's happy and free from sorrow. It's virtually the Christian idea of heaven transposed over into Hinduism, because the Christian idea sounded much more attractive than just being snuffed out and absorbed and escaping from sorrow and trouble. It promised an everlasting life of joy and happiness and peace and in the presence of God. And then that's exactly what these thinkers proposed as a change, a version of Hinduism. So it's always, the Hindu tradition has always been very flexible and very ready to absorb new ideas and to change. And in the late 19th century, another thinker, Ramakrishna, is a theologian of great ability. And he rethought these Hindu doctrines and proposes that they be altered and thought of in new ways as well. And what he comes up with is very, very close to Christianity. There is that about the divine that's inconceivable, but there's that which is knowable as well. And he explains the relationship between the world, the common sense world in which we live, and the divine, as that this world is less real, but it is real, and it has a reality of its own. It isn't just Brahmanatman. It borders very closely on the Jewish Christian doctrine of creation, and it takes, in many ways, many steps close to that. Present-day popular Hinduism continues to be a very great mixed bag. There's still the Hinduism of the Brahmin priests, the old, call it pure Hinduism, of that there's Brahmanatman and that's the only reality, and this world is illusion, and you have to have been reborn into the Brahmin caste to have the spiritual insight to see the truth of that, and then you will, if born into that caste and you do the proper meditations and so on, you will be absorbed and you will not be reborn, you will not be reincarnated. But the popular Hinduism is all over the place. There are local tribal or village gods. There are the three big ones for in official Hindu theology: Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And these are worshipped. People kind of find their own way, and I've often remembered what a Hindu priest said to me one time. Our holy writings aren't like yours, he said to me, talking to me as a Christian. He said, they're not binding. They are there to help me have the experience that I'm seeking and to achieve nirvana. I read them and I hear what they say. If they don't help me, so much the worse for them. I find my own way. That's what it's there. It's to encourage me to find my own way. And they're not binding. They're there as aids only. And so I think that's typical of what we find these days. The attitude toward the world, about how real it is. We've seen in the old original kind of pure Hinduism, this is all illusion. And then you have somebody like Ramakrishna saying, well, no, it's just that it's less real than the divine, but it has its own integrity, it has its own reality. It's worth investigating. That attitude has prevailed among especially the intelligentsia and the Brahmin class, and many of them have become very distinguished scientists. The world is worth investigating. The world is worth finding out how it works, and technology is not to be despised, and science is to be pursued, and so on. And that it's a very open attitude toward that. And I'm emphasizing that because these are some of the ways Hinduism differs from Buddhism, from the next religion that we're going to take up. I also want to point out that all these doctrines in Hinduism are not historical in the sense that Judaism and Christianity and Islam are historical. And what I mean by that, the stories about Krishna and the avatars and the holy men and so on don't depend for their value on whether they actually took place historically. If it turns out that these are just stories, so what? The stories are there to tell us this truth. And it doesn't matter whether they took place historically. Judaism is very different from this. In history, God has intervened into the world, has come into the world and contacted people in order to redeem them. He's come to seek and to save people who are lost and make them his own and redeem them from death. And it happened here and here and with this person and this person. That's very historical. And it's true if and only if those events took place. And Hinduism is not like that at all. If none of those events ever took place, the truth that they want to convey would still be conveyed. And it's not historical in the same sense as others are going to be, Judaism and Christianity and Islam. But that doesn't mean the Hindu doesn't think it's true. It thinks that what is taught is true, certainly. So one of the major differences, and I'm emphasizing it now because I'll explain more about it. We'll come back to it when we cover the others. This is a very complex and complicated tradition. It varies very much from place to place, even within India. The practices, the holy days, and so on, getting into the Ganges River to purify one of sin and so on, is practiced locally there, and not found in other places in India. And the whole idea of evil and sin is very different from what you're going to find, again, in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Here, evil, that is, being sinful, is tied to regarding this world as real. The great sin is to see this as the reality. If you do, you'll value it. You will put all your value on it. If you think it's that this world is real, then you're going to want things, and you're going to want money, and you're going to want comforts and honor and prestige and all that. If you live for that, then you're just going to bind yourself to this illusion. It's either total illusion or it's at least less real than the divine, which is what you want to be entered into in nirvana, and you're going to come back as something worse or at best the same level to try again. You have to achieve that insight that it's being attached to things of this world that is the source of evil. That, again, is radically different from what you find in Judaism and Christianity and Islam. You find there, in the Abrahamic religions, that sin comes out of a lack of love. In Jesus' summary, we're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves. There's the religious and the moral. And the immoral, evil, results from lack of love of one's neighbor. It has nothing to do with being attached to the world. The world's real enough, and the world's okay. It's God's good creation. But you do evil when you act unlovingly and unjustly to other people. But in Hinduism, the source is seen as something very different. It's regarding it as real at all and becoming attached to it. And that's what one tries to detach oneself from in the advanced age of life, when one becomes a hermit and then a wandering mendicant trying to achieve the meditative trance that will transform that person, usher them into nirvana and out of the cycle of rebirth. So I hope that these differences have been made clear, sufficiently clear. There's a great, great deal more to be said about this tradition. This is by way of the most cursory introduction, some of the main doctrines and the doctrinal differences that we're going to encounter between it and other traditions. But if you are interested in this, there's plenty available to read that will bring you more and more and more detail. And I hope that you do pursue it and read it in much greater detail. Now, having made that point about commending the study of Hinduism to you for the future, there are two more points that I want to make about it, because they have to do with how it will contrast with other religions when we get to them. And one of those comes from the Bhagavad Gita. It's a very popular work among common people. And it has a story in it that's very revealing of how Hinduism bears on moral attitudes. And it has to do with Arjuna, who is in command of an army, and he's about to go out and fight, and he has terrible misgivings about all of the people who are going to be killed. And he cries out to Krishna for some help, some advice. And it reads this way: "Krishna, as I behold, come here to shed their common blood. You concourse of our kin, my members fail, my tongue dries in my mouth, a shudder thrills my body, and my hair bristles with horror. Hardly I can stand. What rich spoils could profit? What rule recompense? What span of life seems sweet bought with such blood? Seeing that these stand here ready to die, and for whose sake life was fair, and pleasure and power grew precious, these people, grandsires, sires, sons, brothers, fathers-in-law, sons-in-law, elders and friends." So speaking, in the face of these two armies, Arjuna sank upon his chariot seat and let the bows and arrows fall, sick at heart. Now, what would you expect Krishna's answer to be? Well, it comes something as a surprise, perhaps. "You are grieving where no grief should be. You speak words that lack wisdom. For the wise heart, don't mourn for these that live or die. Nor I, nor you, nor any of these, nor ever was, nor ever will be. Or all that lives, lives forever. Learn this: life is spreading life through all. But for these fleeting frames, which it informs with spirit deathless, infinite and infinite, they perish. Let them perish. Prince, rise and fight. He who shall say, 'Look, I killed someone,' and who shall think, 'Oh, I'm killed,' these both know nothing. Life cannot slay. Life cannot be killed." So the advice is, this world is only illusory. The real life, the reality behind all this, is not going to be affected. So go to it. Get into that war. Kill those people. It's a bit surprising from the standpoint of the Abrahamic religions. And finally, I want to mention one other thing that is very typical of Hindu practice, and that is that the priests and the monks take a very tolerant attitude toward the great religious diversity in India and outside India, both. The attitude is, suppose that we have people that are actually animists. There's a local village in a remote area, and they're worshiping spirits in the trees and the rocks and stuff like that. And a Brahmin priest will come by and participate in their rituals and bless them. The idea behind it is this. These people are doing the best they can with the religious insight that they have at this level of incarnation, of reincarnation. And maybe at the next level they'll be capable of greater spiritual insight and greater until finally they're reborn as Brahmins, and then they'll see what we know. So they take this attitude of great tolerance because they look upon those other religions as people just doing the best they can with what they're capable of doing. And they look upon other religions that way too. They look upon Judaism, Christianity, and Islam as inferior stages of religious insight, which given enough time and enough rebirths, a person will outlive, outgrow, and achieve new insights until they come to the level of a knowledge of a Brahmin, and they know Brahmanatman is the only reality, and then they escape the wheel of rebirth and achieve nirvana. So this is has been a very brief introduction to Hinduism, and we will close with this, and next session we will begin our brief introduction to Buddhism.